Hey everyone, we're back with another special edition of That Jesus Podcast brought to you by the Book of Judges. It's been already been a couple of weeks. We want to do this every week, Lessel, but we've already kind of fell short of that mark.
We had a crazy week last week.
Yeah, well, we had the 4th of July and we had every single one of your siblings up here for the party.
Yep, and then we were also dealing with sickness in and out, so.
And we're still dealing with sickness, so if you hear me coughing or wheezing or just sounding funny, well, you're probably used to that by now. So we are reading the Book of Judges together and talking about it. And what we've been mulling this thing over for almost 3 weeks, Judges chapters 3 and 4. And we'll probably hit briefly chapter 5 because it's kind of part of the same story. And that's a lot of time to spend in just two or three chapters of the Bible. But it stuck with me, this story of a female judge and a warrior woman who does awful, unspeakable things to a man's head. but how has it been having this rolling around in your head for the past 2 or 3 weeks?
I don't necessarily like what Jael did as a New Testament person, but I think she's a very, I don't know, she intrigues me by what, like, she knew who she was, and she wasn't out looking for great things to do, but when she found herself with opportunity, she became great just by doing the right thing in the moment, and she wasn't, I mean, she was in her tent, in her home, and she wasn't looking to do this. It just, the opportunity came to her.
Yeah, well, even before we get to the story of judges, of Deborah, we actually have chapter 3, which is two minor judges. But I think a lot of similar themes, actually. So let's take a look at that. And yeah, so we've already teased the story, the gory story of Jael, but it's not like chapter 3 has a lack of gore. So chapter 3 continues kind of where we left off with Judges 2, the Lord leaving nations in Canaan, in the promised land, in order to test all those in Israel who had not experienced the wars. And it says he specifically did this to test them, to make sure that they would follow through. He wasn't letting them rest on their forefathers' laurels. Say that 3 times quickly. He wasn't letting them rest on their forefathers' laurels, but said they needed to do it themselves. And of course, instead of driving them out, in verse 5 of chapter 3, it says they settled among the Canaanites, Hethites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. The Israelites took their daughters as wives for themselves, gave their own daughters to their sons, and worshipped their gods.
I had to wonder, so God left these nations in there too. Test them, to teach them how to be people of war. Is that what he says? Doesn't it say something like that? And I'm like, well, is there a New Testament correlation? Like, is that why God allows trials in our lives? And I feel like, yes, we learn and grow from our trials by God's grace. I guess there's part of me that I don't like going too far down that road, because then you get into this, well, you deserved it because you needed to grow or something. So I don't really like that. I think you can take it too far, that thought process. But I don't know. I think ultimately we're in a broken world, and so we will have trials. But God does call us to be people of war in a spiritual sense too.
Yeah, and I think it kind of shows, even in the old covenant, there wasn't just promise that everything would be hunky-dory and just fine. God wanted his people to do something to show that they were faithful. And it feels like the most disturbing stories in the Bible, my mind goes right to Abraham and Isaac.
Yeah, I still don't like that story.
but it's about testing. It's about the same sort of thing that's happening here.
Like, I don't understand that story. It feels like,
yeah. Anyhow, it just is interesting to me that the stories that you and I struggle to wrap our hearts around most of all are ones where it feels like God is letting his people suffer. He's testing them. You know, we could think about Job too. He's just
poking them like with a stick, like a teenager pokes a toad or something. That's not quite fair, I know. Mm-hmm. But I know that when you're... Well, we talked about Ruth and Naomi's at church last Sunday. Mm-hmm. And Naomi's testing and feeling bitter because of everything she'd gone through. And I guess I know that feeling. And so when I think about God allowing stuff to happen to make us strong or whatever, it's yeah. like poke us with a stick and see if we'll jump. And it's a totally... That's a twisted attitude coming from depressed places, and
but I don't think it is actually a twisted attitude coming from depressed places because we see the exact same thing you're expressing. We see Job expressing it. We see the psalmists expressing it, and even. Just reading this when failing devotions, John the Baptist, you know, he mm-hmm. gets locked up in jail and he's like, you know, what gives, Jesus?
Yeah.
Are you actually the Messiah? I don't think it's wrong to question, to doubt, but the question is, how do you deal with that doubt? Mm-hmm. And what the Israelites did here is rather than wrestling through and saying, you know, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Mm-hmm. They got comfortable with the enemies.
Yeah, and
they're like, okay, we'll just make peace with them.
They found themselves giving in, allowing themselves to just, you know, go along with what the enemies did, adopt their gods, marry their daughters, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
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 I just have to note, again, picking up on something we touched on last time, the Israelites took their daughters as wives for themselves, gave their own daughters to their sons, and worshiped their gods. And once again, you get a very clear patriarchal picture. And those who would look at the story of, say, Isaac and Rebecca, or a couple other stories about how, you know, the father picks the child. Well, this shows it happening. But once again, this is a cultural expression, not actually what was supposed to happen. Daughters being given in marriage is not actually a scriptural idea in the sense of one we're supposed to follow, but it does happen. I think the concern here isn't so much about how a boy and a girl get to know each other, but that however it happens, that the community is making sure that their sons and daughters are being faithful to walk in the faith, that they are continuing and that we can support. And really, in this sense, it's an indictment on the whole community that the next generation yet was moving further into paganism through their marriages.
So you're saying that the fathers giving the daughters is a cultural thing of their day, but we don't find God commanding that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so little evidence for how all that's supposed to happen.
Well, unless you go into, I mean, there was some Old Testament or some Mosaic law that does, but really, talks about a man shall leave his father's home.
Yep.
And go to his wife. And you don't have a lot of, like, doesn't really talk about the dad in that situation. Talks about the man finding a wife and leaving home.
Yeah. And I just feel like, you know, our oldest is almost 13. So we're not anywhere near there, but it does flit across my mind sometimes. And I think what we do now with our children is really the role we can play.
Our poor like, children.
If our children grow up and become adults and they marry, you know, a Moabite, then that probably means we did something wrong right now rather than down the road, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll speak for myself. I am the kind of mom that If the child isn't moving out and finding a life of his own, I'm liable to kick them out. They need to.
Yeah.
A kid needs to go find his way in the world, or hers.
Yeah, well, let's move to the first judge here, Othniel. And he's a familiar character because he is the son-in-law of Caleb, who was the last basic. Is it fair to call Caleb a judge?
Well,
he wasn't a judge, but he filled that role of leadership.
Did he really? Wait, well, he did. That's back in Joshua.
It was Joshua and Caleb.
But Joshua passed away before Caleb did, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Yeah.
So Caleb was like the oldest man.
It feels that way to me.
Because Joshua and Caleb were spared from being killed in the fort, so they were very old men.
Yeah. So Othniel married Kenaz, right? No, Othniel was the son of Kenaz, mm-hmm. and he married, what's her name? I don't think that's in our text here, but anyhow. We have the first very clear introduction, or specific introduction, of this cycle of apostasy here.
It happened right off the bat.
Yeah.
So fast.
The Israelites did what was evil in the Lord's sight. They forgot the Lord their God and worshiped the Baals and the Asherah as the Lord's anger burned. And he sold them to King Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram-Naharaim. And the Israelites served for 8 years. I tried to see if there's any sort of pattern for the time frames on these judges, like 8 years, and then they had peace for 40 years, and what was the connection? I couldn't find any, mm-hmm. but that's the basic gist. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's youngest brother, was the deliverer. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. And we see, and I think we touched on this last time, a little bit of ambiguity in the word judge. It means deliverer, and it also means, like we'll see with Deborah in a minute, somebody who gives judgments on what should happen. And
well, it seems like the judges always rose up, conquered the oppressor, or got them out from underneath the oppressor's thumb, and then they turned to that individual to do their judging for them from there.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. This is thinking about one of my guiding questions through this book of what does good leadership look like? It seems like, in my observation, the kind of people who are rebels, pioneers, the sorts of people who kind of come in and knock heads together and make things happen and, you know, free people from their captivity, don't always make the sort of wise, balanced, long-term leaders. You have the trailblazers, the apostles, if you will, and then you have the sort of stable pastoral teacher types. But here in Judges, you feels like you kind of have both.
I don't know. I think that Kenaz was definitely, or not Kenaz.
Othniel.
Othniel was definitely like a man of war. Like we hear about Othniel. Is it in the book of Judges? Joshua? We hear about how Othniel went to battle.
Yeah, that's how he got his wife.
Exactly. And then they had peace for 40 years.
Yeah.
And so he might have been a go out and get it done type of guy, but that's a long period. Like, it was until he died then, from then on out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't.
Maybe we just don't know yet.
I don't think we, like, I think that there were probably some guys who did balance both of that, those things well, and some who blew it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, take Samson.
Yeah, or Gideon. Yeah.
Gideon blew it.
Yeah, well, he didn't really have.
Yeah. Oh,
we'll get to him eventually.
Yeah, I don't actually, like, I know, well, this is part of the reason I need to go through the Old Testament, is I don't have all of the story in my head.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to know as far as the question of leadership here, it says that the Lord raised up Othniel, son of Kenaz, and as you already said, Lussell, he had already risen up to fight, and that's how he got his wife. Mm-hmm. So I find it interesting, though. It says that the Lord raised him up, the Spirit of the Lord came on him, and he judged. So at least in this first judge, we have an example of God choosing him. It wasn't like he volunteered and stepped forward. He was voluntold.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we have anything to say to that, except that God chose him, but it's clear that he was also available. He was also active. He was also ready, and he showed that he was committed to fight for Yahweh. So, however that fits together.
And we go on to Ehud, and again, the Lord Lord raised up. He raised up Ehud, son of Jura.
Yeah.
The left-handed Benjamite. Why is that important to let us know that he was left-handed?
Well, it's a pretty pivotal feature in the story.
What happened? Why is it pivotal?
Well, okay, so you have Ehud.
Oh, because he was able to stab the guy in the gut with the left hand.
Yeah.
While he's shaking with his right. How's that? Shaking isn't what they did.
No, but you usually expect a warrior to come in and be armed with his right hand. You keep an eye on their right hand.
And so he was able to. Gotcha.
But, okay, you have to remember, this was probably not a very... how do I say this? This man was probably not a very quick man, considering his weight.
Eglon.
Yeah, and yeah. So regardless of which hand he used.
Yeah. Well, let's walk through the story just a little bit here. The Israelites do evil, which in the sight of the Lord, after 40 years of peace, and Othniel dies. So it's like the judges are the only thing holding them back from evil. It's kind of lame. And Eglon brings the Ammonites and the Amalekites together, and they fight and defeat Israel and take possession of them. And they served him for 18 years this time. So they started out with something like 8 years before Othniel stepped in. Now it's 18 years. And then they cried out to the Lord after 18 years, and he raised up Ehud, like you said, a raising up of a judge rather than a judge saying, I'm going to do this, and God saying, okay, I'll get behind you.
Did that ever happen?
Well, I guess we'll find out. I don't know, but I think that sometimes, yeah, I'm not sure. I think it was almost always God calling them.
Yep.
So, Ehud makes for himself a double-edged sword 18 inches long. So just picture.
Whoa.
Yeah.
18 inches.
Yeah, it's a little bit more than a dagger in my mind. That's half a meter for our international listeners.
Unbelievable. And the whole thing went in there.
Yeah. So he brought tribute to King Eglon. So he has this whole conspiracy going. He's like, I'm going to bring the tax money to Eglon. But I'm going to bring an 18-inch spear with me, or sword with me. If the guy was skinny, he wouldn't have needed something that long. Just saying. So Ehud presents the tribute, the taxes. He dismisses the people who carried this in, because this was before the day of bitcoins and credit cards. And so they had to carry all this stuff in. And he says, I have a secret message for you. This is all, cloak and dagger stuff. I mean, this is all very... He's trying to be secretive about it. Eglon totally falls for it. The king says silence and dismisses the attendants. And then Ehud approaches him. I have a message from God for you. And again, the irony is rich here. What's your message? Here you go. And yes, in the famous words of the Bible, Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into Eglon's belly. Even the handle went in after the blade, and Eglon's fat closed in over it, so that Ehud did not withdraw the sword from his belly, and the waste came out. Ehud escaped by way of the porch, closing the doors and locking the doors of the upstairs room, and they didn't find him until things really started to stink. So,
no.
Yeah,
they waited until they were embarrassed and saw that he did not open the doors of the upstairs room.
Oh, come on. It says somewhere that it stinks.
No. You dreamed it. Honey, they're not going to let the king start rotting. That would be 3 days.
Yeah, maybe I just got a little too imaginative.
I'm sure it stank if his waste came out.
Well, exactly.
But I don't think from...
Yeah, but this was just the springboard into Ehud's escape and then his call to Israel to fight. Follow me, because the Lord has handed over your enemies, the Moabites, to you. So they followed him, captured the fords of the Jordan, leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. Of course, the fords would have been very strategic, and just not letting people cross over was pretty smart. They struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all stout and able-bodied men, unlike the king. Not one of them escaped. And they had peace for 80 years. And Moab, I love this, Moab didn't just like run away. They became subject. So they ended up, well, I don't know if they paid tribute, but.
Well, like it switched, what's the word?
It flip-flopped the controls.
Yeah.
And then you have Shamgar. And Shamgar.
I wish we knew that story better. Like, what does that mean? How do you strike down 600 Philistines with a cattle prod?
Yeah. There's the children's song. Shamgar had an ox goad. Rahab had a string.
Shamgar had an ox goad.
No. Shamgar had an ox goad. See? Rahab had a string.
Here you are again.
Dorcas had a needle. David had a sling. Anyhow. Samson had a jawbone.
What's that other kid's tune that you know the wrong tune to?
I don't know. It's not wrong. It's just different, Lissel.
I'm sure.
Okay, but yes. After Mr. Shamgar. Ehud, we have Mr. Shamgar, the son of Anath. He also delivered Israel. And it seems like he kind of comes on the tail end of Ehud, and they kind of work together, which I like that. But for me, the big theme here, the big theme from this chapter is that Shamgar with his ox goad or cattle prod, Ehud with his left hand and his 18-inch spear, they were unexpected. They didn't follow the rules of the game. And I guess I feel like that's going to be a theme again throughout the whole book, that God used people you wouldn't expect to do this, and he used unexpected means. Mm-hmm. So should we try and cover Deborah and Barak too?
Yeah,
They've been in our subconscious for a long time.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a bit about the story here?
Well, I'm looking over this. I'm trying to decide if Barak was ever considered a judge. Was Barak considered a judge, or was Barak like Deborah? Is it Deborah? Is that how you say it? Or Deborah? Or Deborah?
I actually looked it up, and I think it's fine to just say Deborah.
But there's an O there.
Yep.
Anyway.
But I think you're right that Deborah was the judge. She was the prophetess. It says in verse 4, Deborah, a prophetess and the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the judge. Mm-hmm. Israel was doing evil in the sight of the Lord at this time, but they still had a judge. Now, she was a woman judge,
mm-hmm.
but there was a judge. And I don't think, and somebody can help me out here, we can put an addendum, but I don't really think there's anywhere in the Bible, and especially not these chapters, where Barak is explicitly called a judge. It's almost like he's kind of a servant of Deborah. He's Deborah's general, but he falls under her authority.
It's very interesting, actually.
Yeah. And to be clear, he falls doesn't just fall under her authority. He places himself under her authority and says, I don't want to go out by myself. Yeah. So Israel cries out to the Lord because Jabin had 900 iron chariots and Jabin harshly oppressed them 20 years. So she settles disputes. She's clearly a judge. She's there.
I'd like to know how she became one.
I don't know.
It was undisputed that she was the judge. There was no, you don't hear anything in this, like, and you would too. Like, if that was a disputed point, I think it would be in the story,
mm-hmm.
but it's not.
Yeah.
So
she is settling disputes and she summons Barak. I love that. She just summons the guy and says, hasn't the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go deploy the troops on Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from Naphtalites and Zebulunites. Then I will lure Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, his chariots, and his infantry at the Wadi Kishon to fight against you, and I will hand him over to you. So the first thing I notice about this is she asks this rhetorical question. Hasn't the Lord God of Israel commanded you?
So, did the Lord talk to him privately and he waited around for her to summon him?
It doesn't specify, but it does. It sounds like that. Again, I don't speak Hebrew or read it or understand it.
Well, it feels like he knew enough.
Exactly.
To know that when she said that, there would be no arguing. And in some way, it made sense in his mind that, yes, God was asking this of him.
Exactly. And I kind of wonder if it wasn't, again, God calling Barak, but he wasn't really willing to go until somebody else called him out on it. Mm-hmm. And of course, in verse 8, he's like, if you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go.
You know what the thing is that God still used and called Barak in spite of his, how he felt about it. So it's just because Barak was not wanting to do it, God still used him, even with his weak knees and his jelly. I don't know.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big takeaways for me, is that God is going to get his work accomplished. Mm-hmm. Whether he has to use a left-handed guy or a woman or Barak, who's kind of a coward.
Well, I don't think it's like he has to. It's God chooses to do it that way.
Well,
on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. But God will get his work done. It's not like, oh, if Barak isn't going to do it, or if Barak acts afraid, now all of a sudden God's up there wringing his hand saying what he's going to do.
Yeah.
No, when God wants to accomplish something great, he invites us to participate. And it's up to us whether we do it or not.
Yep.
So so she says, I will gladly go with you, but you will receive no honor on the road you're about to take. Ouch.
Yeah.
Because the Lord will sell Sisera to a woman. So they go up. And there's a lot you could dig into here if you want to look at kind of the history and the archaeology and the commentaries about who went and who didn't go and where they went. But just to kind of get to the heart of the story, they had a successful campaign. You have this guy, Heber, the Kenite. He'd moved away from the Kenites, which this is going back to Moses' family way back in the day.
Yeah.
But he pitched his tent. It kind of feels like halfway between, like in the DMZ, the no man's land, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then Sisera and Barak have it off. Deborah again has to tell in verse 14. She has to tell Barak, go, this is the day the Lord has handed Sisera over to you. Hasn't the Lord gone before you? She has a lot of rhetorical questions to ask of the cowardly man.
Then again, maybe he wasn't cowardly. Maybe God was speaking directly through her, and she was asking rhetorically in order to show him how confident she was of it.
Yeah. And do you think it's like God did the same thing with Joshua back when Joshua was supposed to go into the land? He's like, haven't I commanded you be strong and courageous? He does that like 4 times in the first chapter of Joshua. It's not necessarily a sin to be nervous or to even have a cowardly impulse. Mm-hmm. And so you could look at this and say, oh, look at the woman, you know, getting the upper hand here over the man, and he was such a coward. Or you could say, look at the beauty of community and you know, where you have two people fighting together so much stronger than just one person. I don't think we have to be ashamed of needing the courage.
And
the
encouragement. We shouldn't be too quick to call somebody a coward just because, I mean, you're not a coward until you refuse to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Barak comes down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And I do like that picture. After Barak, again, you're right to call me on it, but I kind of have this picture in my mind that, you know, Barak is kind of peeking out from behind Deborah's skirts. But then when it actually comes to the fight, Barak comes down from Mount Tabor and he has 10,000 men coming behind him, which is kind of cool. And the Lord threw Sisera and all of his iron charioteers and all his army into a panic before Barak's assault. And Sisera has to leave his chariot. Remember, the chariots were the things that made Israel feel like they couldn't do anything.
But, so, I just think that's interesting. I guess, was it the chariots or their horses? Really? Well, like, because it seems like you had horses and chariots would be more clumsy than men just on horseback.
Yeah, I guess I don't know
the dynamics, I guess.
But from what I read, and just following the text, it sounds like the big threat was those 900 chariots. And think back even to Pharaoh, and he had his chariots, and that was what was scary to Israel. It's always about the chariots.
Yeah, I just have to wonder, like, what is the advantage in battle to having a man drawn behind a horse on a chariot versus people actually being just on horseback? But what were the weapons they were using?
Yeah. Yeah. But one way or the other, he left his iron chariot and he makes the mistake of stopping by somebody's house. Of course, so verse 17, he flees on foot to the tent of Jael.
The whole army of Sisera died. Not one was the last man standing as king.
Yeah, good point. Verse 16, Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth of the nations, and the whole army of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a single man was left.
That has got to be devastating.
No wonder he fled. And so so when you're at that point, you know, just pour one out for poor Sisera here. You're at that point and you're like, I need somebody. I've got to have at least one ally left on the earth. And so he flees on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because there was peace between King Jabin, his boss, and the family of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to greet Sisera and said to him, "Come in, my lord. Come in with me. Don't be afraid." So he went into her tent and she covered him with a blanket.
Sisera wasn't the king.
No.
Sisera, who is Sisera?
He was the general. You can go back to verse 7. Sisera, commander of Jabin's army.
Okay.
Yeah. And so Jael's husband was supposed to be chummy with Sisera's boss. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." She opened a container of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him again. Then he said to her, "Stand at the entrance of the tent. If a man comes and asks you, 'Is there a man here?' say, 'No.'" And then why don't you tell us what happens in verse 21?
While he was sleeping from exhaustion, Heber's wife Jael took a tent peg, grabbed a hammer, and went silently to Sisera. And she hammered the peg into his temple and drove it into the ground, and he died. She must have been a strong woman, actually.
Yeah, and he must have been really tired. But,
yeah. We don't have to think too hard about that.
I just think that these two stories we've looked at, it's all about pointy objects and overkill. It's all about the overkill. And so Barak arrives in pursuit of Sisera. Jael goes out to meet him and says, "Come and I will show you the man you were looking for." So he went in with her, and there was Sisera lying dead with a tent peg through his temple. That day, God, not Jael, not Barak, not Deborah, God subdued King Jabin of Canaan before the Israelites. The power of the Israelites continued to increase against King Jabin until they destroyed him.
So Jabin was, what was he king of? What's the enemy?
The king of Canaan.
Of Canaan? Yeah. They were all Canaanites. I don't understand.
Yeah, sometimes the geography gets a little bit confusing here, but at the very beginning of chapter 4, that's how he's introduced. Okay. King Jabin of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. So, because remember, this was Israel's big problem. Instead of driving people out, they're like, "We'll just kind of compromise and mix it up with them." Mm-hmm. So they destroy King Jabin, and then they sing a song about it. Of course, this is on that day. Deborah and Barak did this duet, and we won't read the whole thing, but it's quite repetitive. It tells a story with great dramatic flair, shall we say, and maybe even humor. Like, let me just read the very end of this. I had to turn my page here. Okay. Cicero's mother looked through the window. She peered through the lattice, crying out, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why don't I hear the hoofbeats of his horses?" Her wisest princesses answer her. She even answers herself. "Are they not finding and dividing the spoil, a girl or two for each warrior? The spoil of colored garments for Sisera, the spoil of an embroidered garment or two for my neck. Lord, may all your enemies perish as Sisera did, but may those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its strength." And the land had peace for 40 years. So yeah, they sing this really long song with a lot of like biting sarcasm.
She reached for a tent peg, her right hand for a workman's hammer. Then she hammered, crushed his head, shattered and pierced his temple. What I don't get is it says he collapsed, he fell, he lay down between her feet. She was actually asleep. A lot of poetic.
It's poetic license.
Yeah.
I like how they did that right before, too. She is most blessed among tent-dwelling women. He asked for water. She gave him milk. She brought him cream in a majestic bowl. So that's the story of Deborah and Barak and Jael and Sisera. What are your thoughts?
I like how Jael knew where her loyalties were. She knew her story. She knew the history. She knew that she was the Israelites' probably cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was important to her, and she understood her connection with them. And so when push came to shove, she stood with her people, or her people's people, really. Yeah. And I think that's fascinating. And I think that, well, like I said before, she was home doing what she did at home when this came to her. She wasn't out there trying to be the next Deborah or whatever. She just did what was right in the moment as it came to her where she was at.
Yeah, I mean, what literally what just came to her front door.
Exactly.
And there are so many examples, Rahab and mm-hmm. Abigail,
mm-hmm.
of women who are like, I know that I'm not on the right side of this fight from how it looks on the outside,
mm-hmm.
but I'm actually going to side with God's chosen people.
Yep.
And
yeah.
And it goes well for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. And it makes me wonder, is it okay to say, coming back to their questions about testing, in crisis, when you actually come down and you have to choose sides, that really kind of tells you who you are. Mm-hmm. And it shows who's on God's side, even if you wouldn't expect it, and who's not. Because, you know, what's her name? Was it Habor or Hazor? Jael's husband? Like, he was supposed to be pals with them.
Yeah.
And I just...
Yeah. I think the thing I have to think about when you say that is often in the Old Testament, on our end of the story, where we're reading it, we are seeing how, how Jael was, like, we're looking at Jael and saying, wow, you did an amazing thing. But you have to say, what was it, her husband?
Mm-hmm.
What did he say to her? Like, what did you just do with my relationship with the king?
Well, but she was, I mean, like, again, it worked out really well for them. Because she had a song written about her, and the king that they had aligned with
mm-hmm.
was defeated.
Yeah. So. I guess what my thing is sometimes when you're in the hard moment and you make the decision you feel like is the best, we're living in a different era.
Yeah.
And we don't always get to see or feel happy feelings for having done what was right, other than just the confidence and the peace that we did it right. But sometimes the chips don't always fall where we thought they were going to fall.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. They don't always fall where you'd expect them. And sometimes we don't even see where they fall in the
end. That's the thing. That's what I'm like. We're on the other end of the story. We see where the chips fell. And I just have to, like, I have to. You can think about Rahab. And she made the right decision. She, you know, her family, she was spared. But, and we look at her and we say, wow. But I'll bet you there were times where she said, why did I leave Jericho? Maybe I'm wrong. Well, but like, what about all of the friends she lost? What about the culture shock? Mm-hmm. Like, I've done culture stuff. That is no fun.
Yeah.
And the Israelites were weird.
Yeah, just because you make the right choice. I mean, she married an Israelite. Rahab did. Just because you make the right choice, and it's the good choice even, and it's the choice that lets you survive, it doesn't mean that it's always easy.
Yeah. Yep.
One of our listeners, I'll just read to you what he said. Our friend JLP says, do you have any allegorical interpretations for the story of Ehud? Perhaps this king being laziness and sloth and how we must strike the flesh with the sword of the spirit. So that was about Ehud, and he's saying that we should look at Ehud, the king, representing laziness and sloth, and we must strike him with the sword of the spirit. He's talking about allegorical interpretations, and up to this point, I think we've avoided that. But I do want to ask, I told him I'd read that out, so there you go, Joshua Light Parker. I do want to ask you, though, what do you think about, like, those sorts of allegorical representations?
I am really hesitant to read allegorical interpretations into things, because then we end up, when we end up putting too much into scripture, we, especially depending on the story, we get the wrong thing out of the story, mm-hmm. because we aren't reading what the story is about then. We're like, trying to get more out of the story than's actually there, and then we miss the main point in the process. And you end up with things like, well, then you end up with unintended guilt trips. And so, I mean, that's great if you want to read that and say this is an interesting idea, that's fine, but I would never be comfortable teaching that.
Yeah.
I feel like it's pretty... It's a far stretch.
Yeah, and along with that, where you kind of miss the point of the story, and this is really about God's redemption and God using unlikely things to bring about His work. Uh-huh. When you start talking about, oh, you must smite the spirit of laziness and sloth, well, all of a sudden you're reading more into the text than was there, and you could start twisting it too. And like somebody's overweight and you're saying, oh, well, you're like King Eglon. And this is why we've got to be so careful with the Old Testament when we get that granular and that specific. It can be fun. I've heard people, you know, preach whole sermons on, you know, the five giants that David faced or whatever. And it's like, but you're making your whole message not really about the Bible anymore. It's your kind of fanciful interpretation of the Bible. So, yeah, if you want to send those in, JLP, like, I think we'll probably be amused and maybe even mildly edified, but that's not really where we're headed. So if you want to add that as kind of a potpourri, that's great.
It's good on the Facebook discussion.
And I think it can be, sometimes be cool to make those connections personally in your heart, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's like, that's really, like... Especially if you're a person who is fighting and struggling with laziness and you read something like that, sometimes the Holy Spirit does move that way for you personally, and it's kind of a cool thing to share. But I don't feel like, I don't know,
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to say that because I don't.
As a general rule, that's not really where you yeah. want to land, especially if
no,
you're teaching.
No.
That's not where the authority comes from those allegorical fantasies.
Yeah. I do think, like, I believe that there are some types in shadows. Yeah. Like, yeah, like, even what we have Elisha and Elijah.
Yep. And John the Baptist.
And John the Baptist, that's what I was trying to say. So, yeah, there are those types and shadows that are legit. But I feel like in this particular instance, I mean, okay, for one thing, we were never told that Eglon was lazy.
Yep.
That's just not even there.
He just had a desk job.
Yeah, like that's an assumption we're making because he's overweight, and that can be a huge source of guilt to people who are overweight but have legitimate health problems for that. And so it's just not a place I want to go.
Yeah. So with that, we'll zoom way back out, and I just want to kind of wrap up as a good preacher would with my 3 points. Okay. God will accomplish his purposes. He invites us all along to fight with him, but he will get it done one way or the other. He uses cowards, and he uses the unexpected to his advantage. So
I'm still trying to decide if God actually uses cowards.
I self-identify as a coward, especially when it comes to scary men and spiders.
That's so really stupid, because if you self-identify as a coward, then you got yourself in a hole.
But I know that God can use me.
Well, if you get out of your hole, then you're not a coward anymore.
Okay. Well, I think we'll call it good there. Thank you for joining us. Feel free to send your comments and fanciful interpretations, and let us know where we were wrong. Thanks, Lissel.
Yep.
That Jesus Podcast is part of the Kingdom Outpost Podcast Network. For more articles, podcasts, and other resources, go to kingdomoutpost.org.